his attorney came in. That was a sign. I should have run away. This is worse than Scientology.
Okay, shut up. I need you to shut up. I'm going to show you how to tread water.
I can't swim. I don't even put my feet in the water at the beach.
Treading isn't like swimming. You just move a little to keep your head.
Don't let me go. Please, don't let me go.
You're going to pull us under. Sweep your arms back and forth. Then do a flutter kick.
I can't. My arms are hurt. I can only use one leg.
Try. I kept it from going under. Keep your body upright and keep your head. Garrett fired into the pool 6 times, each bullet flying close to us. That stopped the lesson and silenced his wife's frantic words. But she cried. It was uncontrollable, inconsolable, hopeless.
Jesus, no, no.
She winced with pain.
My left leg, it's cramping bad.
I held her while she fought with her pain, and we went under 12 times. When the pain subsided, she let out a wail, shook her head in surrender as if she saw her future, saw the inevitable, then begged,
let me go. Please just let me drown. I've had enough of this.
No, no, there will be no drowning.
I'm in so much pain. This is my fault. This is my fault. Let me die.
I told her, no. She cried a moment.
I'm scared.
I know. Just talk to me, if that helps.
You're a nice man.
My name is Ken Swift.
You're a good man, Ken Swift.
I'm just a man. Just a wounded man with an ex-wife who never loved him, with a girlfriend too good for him, with a daughter who has no connection to him, in the deep end of a pool, treading in cold-ass water, ignoring my own pain, trying to keep you from drowning.
He kicked me down the stairs. Motherfucker kicked me down the goddamn stairs.
You can't be angry right now. Can't have your heartbeat get elevated.
He cut off my hair! And as I lay dying, he put his dick in me. My husband raped me.
Mask off. You have now seen him with his mask off.
Someone needs to teach men not to rape, to respect women as their equals.
I need you to focus right now. I need you to use less energy. Garrett came closer. Unfaithful bitch. Drown with a fucking nigger. Sneezes, orgasms, and anger. They stood around us, watching us go under, take on water, and come back up. They laughed, took bets on how long it would take us to drown. They looked upon me with disdain. Black skin. Different tribes. I was a pit bull, abused and raised on gunpowder. So were they. I saw prison tats, gang tats up to their eyeballs. None were over 25. These gentlemen were from the east side. I said, you left your boy burning in the streets. You'll do the same to all y'all. They looked at one another, contemplated what might have been on their minds. I said, I hope he paid y'all up front. He's not reliable when it comes to paying debts. Garrett hated my words and fired at me. He came like he wanted to give me the John F. Kennedy special and send me to go hang with Biggie, Tupac, and Elvis. He stood at the edge of the pool, smiling at me without lowering his gun. Cagney with his finger on the trigger. He'd had enough of me, enough of his wife. He hated her. And maybe he loved her. Maybe the latter was why she was still alive. This had gone too far to turn it back around. Roses, dinner, and a night of making love. Couldn't fix this. But Garrett didn't seem like the type to issue an apology. He chose a course and stuck to it. It was easier for some men to kill than it ever would be for them to apologize. I'd grown up in the South, and I already knew that some men, educated or illiterati, would never apologize to a black man, educated or illiterati, but would demand an apology, even when the black man wasn't in the wrong. Men like Garrett would never apologize to a woman, but would demand an apology for her every complaint. Those were the most dangerous men on the face of the planet, especially when they had a gun. That gun made Garrett think he was an alpha male's alpha male. Without a gun, Garrett was just an angry Pillsbury doughboy. Men like him would nurture and feed a stray dog, would treat a dog with dignity and kindness, but would shoot me in my back, then go to Burger King, get 2 Whoppers for $6, and feed one to the dog. If Garrett had known his armament was sleeping in the bottom of the pool, with his anger, he could have gone for a quick dive, recovered his toys, loaded up, and done the ultimate drive-by in Leimert Park just to show Jake Ellis who was the boss. With that cache of weapons and the league of bushwhackers he had employed as a well-armed militia, he could have driven from Crenshaw Boulevard down Stocker to Leimert Boulevard, taken that to MLK, shot up the area doing 40 miles per hour, and killed innocents while he slaughtered gentrification. Then been back on the 110 speeding north toward Pasadena before anyone in zip code 90008 had stopped screaming and had the nerve to rise from their floors or crawl from under their kitchen tables. Garrett had come at us the way angered men like him had gone after Nat Turner. As if he had the right to do so. Suffering and dying in slave ships, hanged from trees, whipped to death. Beaten to death by slave catchers dressed in blue, shot dead in the streets, first to die in movies, or first to die in real life. Black death was normal, a non-event, because killing people who had never been completely humanized had never been a crime. History reinforced what savages were capable of doing today. History reassured savages of what they had the right to do, of things that had been labeled as okay to do by the savages that came before them. History lived in their minds became the roadmap for continued manifest destiny. Garrett said, "You came to the wrong house. We had the right address. GPS brought us to your gate. I was the wrong one to cook salmon for. It wasn't personal. I was just doing my job. You know how this business rolls. You break in my house, it's personal. Do you understand how violated I feel? And I don't care if my wife is an unthankful drama queen. That mammothrept is my goddamn wife. Tell San Bernardino you don't like the way things are done. Not me. Touch my wife. It's personal. I never touched her. You ate my damn gelato. I didn't want to be rude. Keep that sense of humor. It will serve you well as a court jester in hell." This pool had become my jail. And when he pulled the trigger, it would be my grave. As the freezing night air moved through a jungle of palm trees, as the American flag waved, I had no way out. I knew this was a wrap. I would be shot a few times, then die with lungs filled with water. But an abrupt crash made us jump, made everyone turn toward the mansion. Glass broke, shattered, and a 2-cell cinder block that weighed about 35 pounds flew like it weighed as much as a bottle of lotion. Garrett and his men shouted, ducked, then regained their composure, looked at the cinder block that had flown through the patio window. It had been slung with hawk-like rage from inside of the estate. It was the same cinder block Garrett had used to damage Jake Ellis's Mustang. Jake Ellis was here. Fury, his traveling companion. I couldn't see Jake Ellis from where I was in the pool, but they did. Mr. Garrett saw the African he'd called what white men, both rich and poor, had called black men, both rich and poor, for hundreds of years. Chapter 23. Mr. Garrett ran by palm trees in his private yard, ran by patio furniture unseen by anyone because of the high walls, ran with his well-fed belly jiggling as he bolted toward the broken door, gun aimed, ready to shoot. Infuriated, as he said, "He's here. The African is here." Garrett had been waiting for Jake Ellis all along. He had kept me cold, tired, beaten, weakened. Three of his men stayed at the pool, tasked with watching us drown. Mr. Garrett took the rest, running with him, each picking up a makeshift weapon on the way, each confident. Hours ago, Jake Ellis and I had broken into this 9-bedroom mansion, gone room to room and collected weapons. Then we had stood out here under palm trees, by fruit trees, in an enclosed backyard, secluded from the world, Garrett's gun collection sealed in plastic while magically moist salmon cooked in the oven. And we dropped it all in the bottom of this pool. I whispered, "We're going underwater for a few seconds."
"No, no,
Mrs. Garrett."
"Elaine, my name is Elaine."
"Mrs. Garrett, I know you're scared as hell, but I'm going to have to let you go, and I'll need you to hold your breath as long as you can. Have to go to the bottom. If you don't, we might die tonight."
"No, no, I can't go underwater, and I can't hold my breath for a second."
"Take a deep breath. I'll be back for you in no time."
"Don't, please don't."
A moment ago, she wanted to die. Now, she wanted to live. I had no other choice but to chance letting her drown. I pushed her away, let her go, watched her eyes widen as she freaked out and looked at me like I had betrayed her, watched her fight the water like she was fighting an ocean, then surrender to gravity, hold her breath, and go under. I took several deep, slow breaths, fought my pain, and tried to bend, had to get my legs in the air, had to get my head facing down, had to fight to swim downward while I exhaled slowly to equalize the pressure. I wasn't gonna make it. I was going to drown in Pasadena. Couldn't turn back. Held my nose and blew. Had to equalize the pressure a bit more in order to kick away discomfort in my ears. Wiggled my jaw. Bottom of the pool felt like it was deeper than the Y-40 Deep Joy in Italy. And that pool was 113 feet deep. They had me beat good. Everything hurt. Even my thoughts. Had to use a lot of energy to go this short distance. Needed to go back up, but I touched the bottom. Fought with the little air left in my lungs, trying to make me float toward the top. If I went back up, I'd never make it back down. I ran my hands along the bottom of the pool. Blue bubble rings. Felt death begging me to exhale. Then inhale one last time. One deep breath could fix it all. No more taxes. No more problems. Then I touched the edges of one of the black plastic garbage bags. It was hard to see the armament. The bag was too heavy to lift and carry to the surface. 10 rifles and a cache of automatic weapons were down at Davy Jones' locker, too, but those were too heavy to lift. Garrett had more guns than a domestic terrorist. Severe gun ownership was part of his privilege. In my world, men who owned weapons like this were either paranoid or mental. Usually both. I struggled with the bag, turned it over until I found the plastic drawstring, exhaled some oxygen as I tugged it open, and reached inside. Inside this bag were 10 Ziploc bags that had been used to hermetically seal each handgun. The Ziploc bags were huge, waterproof. Everything had been layered like Christmas presents. Rifles and assault guns had been wrapped in saran wrap, some put in giant Ziploc bags, then everything was dropped inside hefty garbage bags. We had been careful. We had used 3 layers of plastic to keep the weapons dry. 10 handguns were sleeping at the bottom of the deep end of the pool. Garrett had never found them. Or maybe he had never looked for them. He assumed we had stolen them. He saw 2 black men and saw 2 thieves. He'd been busy shoving his wife downstairs. He'd been busy recruiting warriors to come after me and Jake Ellis. After he'd squared up his tab with San Bernardino, we would have told San Bernardino where the guns were, and San Bernardino would have let him know where his armament was. Lungs burning like a California wildfire, I struggled, grappled, grabbed the first gun I could. Didn't care the caliber, but it felt like a Glock. It slipped from my hands, and I had to fight with my lungs and the slipperiness of the plastic. I was underwater, trying to rush without panicking, knowing Mr. Garrett would reappear and start shooting down and offing me in this watery grave. He'd shoot until he saw red water rising and diluting to pinkness. I wasn't sure if I could shoot a Glock underwater without modification, but I knew if I shot upward, I'd be shooting blind. Water didn't compress and could bind in the firing pin chamber, and a shot from this deep underwater would be non-lethal. The shot wouldn't be accurate, and even if I got lucky, it wouldn't have the velocity it needed to kill a motherfucker who was standing over me trying to gun me down. The Glock had to stay in the Ziploc until I surfaced. Mind was in a frenzy, was delirious from pain and the need to breathe. I couldn't carry 2 Gats and swim to the top. Not when one felt like it weighed 100 pounds. I didn't have time to sort that out, so I tucked the first Glock in my waistband, hoped it was loaded, then got my feet under me, touched the bottom of the pool, and pushed upward, pushed, and felt the last of the air escape my body. As I glided upward, the gun moved down the left pant leg of my joggers, became awkward weight, worked against me, tried to anchor me to the bottom. This wasn't working. Had to keep going. I looked up and saw nothing but darkness, but didn't think I'd make it back to the top, and the surface looked like it was a mile away. I had taken my last breath. I wouldn't live long enough to inhale fresh air again. Dread owned me. I was in hell, pounds of water standing on my head. Garrett's pool was on Garrett's side. This water was his water. My body wanted oxygen and did its best to force me to breathe. I wanted to breathe, holding my breath when it gets what my body needed. I felt the carbon dioxide level accumulating in my blood. I had to breathe. I was suffocating. It was a battle that no man could win. When I was about to black out, when it was too intense and my body tried to force me to gulp and try to drink an ocean of chlorine, I broke the surface, breathless, wheezing like I'd run 2 marathons uphill and back to back at top speed, came from a cold, watery womb into the world like a baby being born, right next to Mrs. Garrett's nude, bald, battered, lifeless body. Chapter 24. Struggling to breathe, I turned Mrs. Garrett over on her back, tried to keep her head above water. She wasn't breathing. Struggling to stay afloat, Glock nestled in the leg of my joggers. I tried to kick, side stroke, and pull Mrs. Garrett to the side. Wanted to get to the edge of the pool, but the 3 homies Garrett had left behind came after us. I heard them talking. Couldn't understand a word they said. They thought I had drowned and was surprised when I had come back to the surface. My mind was fractured. A woman had drowned. One of Garrett's henchmen had been sent to follow Jimmy Lee. And Jake Ellis was here. Garrett and his gun were after him. There was noise inside the mansion, a battle I could barely hear. My ears were waterlogged. Another of the mansion's windows broke, and a body flew out head first, landing on top of the barbecue grill, a big number that had two propane tanks. They had Jake Ellis. They had trapped, shot, and killed Jake Ellis. The thugs hurried over to see the broken body. When they turned back toward me, I was out of the pool and pulled Mrs. Garrett with me. She was on her side, still not moving, still not breathing. I left her as she was. Jake Ellis was my priority. Limping across concrete, water dripping from my joggers like rain, wounded from head to toe, barely able to inhale, I hobbled toward the body. The thugs called out, hurried toward me. They expected me to try to escape, and they knew I was in no shape to run. They came at me until they saw the Glock. They were 10 feet away when they realized I was armed, and their charge came to a sudden stop. Attitudes changed. The captors became the prisoners. Each had a shocked expression, wondering where the hell I had gotten a gun from, wishing Garrett had left them strapped. They had been overconfident. They didn't need to worry about the gun. Guns never killed anyone. Bullets were grave makers. And I had 17. I expected at least one to jump bad, become badder than Jim Croce's legendary Leroy Brown. And one did think he was badder than a junkyard dog and meaner than King Kong. One always did. He stepped forward, came toward me. That motherfucker ain't gonna shoot nobody. Before the baddest of the bad man could say another fucking word, I pulled the trigger, opened fire. I fired 6 times. The one who acted the baddest went down first. Then the one who was the biggest charged at me. He contracted lead poisoning in the middle of his chest. He went down on a knee, then collapsed. I never shot at anything I didn't want dead. But even now, with my life on the line, it was hard to put a man down. The third man's skin was as dark as the night, the hue of a king. He stood in his spot, didn't run, and despite my gun and 2 men at my feet, he wasn't gonna run. He wore a Denver Broncos skull cap, a Punisher t-shirt, and black sweatpants, his knuckles raw from beating me. I said, "Black man." He spoke like he was holding a gun. "Get back in that pool." His accent told me he was Dominican. Black like me, with roots of the same tree. Only his ancestor's boat, one with hundreds of enslaved Africans, had stopped in the West Indies. African, West Indian, or born in America or the UK, to men like Garrett, we were all niggers. My lost brother challenged me. Sometimes, the hardest thing to do was convince a black man he didn't have to yield a Pavlovian response and jump for men like Garrett, that he didn't have to answer to the bell that called out niggers. Gun in hand, I faced a black man who frowned at me like I was suffering from drapetomania. And I scowled at him like he was the one who had been brainwashed. I nodded. "You know I'll die in that pool. If I couldn't swim, I'd already be dead." "That's my job, to keep you in the pool. If you drown, that's on you."
"Walk away."
"Dead bodies, burning buildings, and a dead woman? We gone too far to walk away."
I motioned toward the back door. "Walk away."
"I can't. He ain't paid me yet."
"I want you to just walk away."
"Shit, nigga. I can't walk away broke. I had 3 kids. I can't go home broke."
I said, "Well, I guess one of us won't be around for the Black Panther movie." We had fallen into a civil war, union against a fighter for the Confederacy.
He braced himself, made himself feel bulletproof, then ran at me, screaming. My gat kicked, spat twice, put lead in his face and in the middle of the Punisher's skull. Dropped him between his second and third steps. He got the JFK special and a chest shot, then fell on his co-workers, became kindling on the pile. I wondered what the other men's stories were, how we ended up here at odds. Men who were sons, fathers, lovers, men who traveled the same pothole-filled road I had traveled since birth, a road that was designed for men like us and went only uphill. Men I would have called my brothers in the street or stood with or kneeled with at a rally for justice. Now they were unmoving, dying on damp concrete in puddles of their own blood. Those same men would have stood poolside and sipped a beer while I drowned. In the back of my mind, I heard a voice whispering a rumor, something some black folks claimed Harriet Tubman said, something not confirmed, yet I'd read it many times.
I freed 1,000 slaves. I could have freed 1,000 more, if only they knew they were slaves. A noise came from behind me, and I turned, stumbled with pain, ready to shoot again. No man was there in the shadows. No one was hiding behind a palm tree. It was Mrs. Garrett. The bruised woman was on her side, coughing, puking, shivering, in agony, but alive. Death had come to visit, had tea, but changed his heart, maybe left for bigger prey. That or the God that protected fools and babies had come to her side. That God hadn't rescued any black men tonight. Didn't matter if we were here or in Barbuda or Vieques. My designated people had to find the right God and learn to be our own gods. There hadn't been a deus ex machina for Flint or St. Louis. We'd been living between two seas, praying for a deus ex machina since 1619. Praying was wishing, and I knew that there was no genie in the bottle. Mrs. Garrett vomited herself back to life while all of my thoughts went by in two blinks and a shuddering exhale, an exhale of relief. Now I had to get to Jake Ellis. My heart tried to beat out of my chest. I limped, and in panic, I gazed down on the broken body. My eyes burned, focused. It wasn't Jake Ellis. I scowled upward, looked up at the back side of the mansion, heard a fight going on, one that sounded like Uganda's parliament was back in session. I stepped back, tried to figure what rooms were over my head. Either Jake Ellis had thrown one of Garrett's men out of the window during their fight, or the street soldier saw what he was up against and decided to jump out and killed himself by landing on his head. I headed for the broken patio door, but before I made it 10 steps, someone yelled for their life. A man screamed. Right away, another window broke. Someone tried to escape, flew out of the mansion like he was trapped in the winds of a hurricane. Glass broke, and he dropped fast and crashed on concrete. He crashed at a bad angle. Two legs snapped like twigs. The man was as broken as fuck, howled like there was no tomorrow. He had two knots on his head. One was the size of the Rock of Gibraltar, the other the size of Stawama's chief. What mattered to me was that that gentleman wasn't Jake Ellis. I couldn't tell by his face, but I could tell by his body. His skin was the wrong shade of black. I held the Glock in my hand. Water made my joggers felt like they weighed a ton. The night air made my heavy clothing turn cold against my skin. Pool water drained from my joggers like I needed a catheter, left a trail, dripped over dry concrete as I stumbled around broken glass, avoided getting my feet cut, then dripped across swank rugs and heated marble floors when I went inside the Garrett's mouth of luxury. I heard echoes from a battle upstairs and hurried that way, realizing the kitchen still smelled like magically moist salmon. Chapter 25. One of Garrett's bushwhackers stumble ran down the stairs, bolted past all the amazing sculptures and art, tripped on his big feet, fell and got back up with panic, and again ran like his life depended on his escape. His face was jacked. A huge knot on his forehead, left eye bleeding, a river. He'd suffered an absolute beatdown. His face had been pummeled by a pugilist. Probably was dealing with the effects of a concussion. The tall man in jeans and a North Face sweatshirt looked like something out of a Stephen King novel. He wobbled until he saw me. He saw me with the gun pointed at him, then cursed, took a breath, and dropped down on one knee. Then took another breath, eased down on both knees. He made pained sounds as he panted and raised his swollen hands. His right hand looked as broken as his spirits. The way he moved and groaned, I think his ribs were shattered too. He'd been too close to a real fighter. The bushwhacker frowned. You're not dead. Fuck. What are you made of? Bad luck, hard times, and trouble. He chuckled. Just to underscore how serious this was, I fired a shot near his head. He trembled. Hands up, don't shoot! Hands up, please, don't shoot! Don't scream. Just don't shoot me. I don't want to get shot again. You caught some hot lead tonight? 3 years ago, right in the ass. Don't want to ever get shot again. That shit hurts. Where's my recalcitrant friend? Your what? Where is the pissed off African? Long as that crazy man ain't by me, he's alive. I think so. Harder to kill than a goddamn Alabama cockroach. How bad is he hurt? Might have been shot point blank 2 or 3 times.
Fuck. Then he could be dead.
Fuck. I should have stayed my black ass at home and watched Game of Thrones.
Garrett, the African upstairs?
There was.
How many men on your side?
I don't know and I don't care. It's like every man for himself right now.
But the African might be alive.
He panted.
How in the hell Africans end up slaves if Africans fight like that?
Read a book.
Read a book?
Read a motherfucking book. Then booms came from upstairs. It sounded like a bull charging into a wall over and over. The brother on the floor heard the noise and wanted to rise. I fired off another round, again near him, let him know I was his brother, but I was not his friend. Not in the middle of a stupid-ass war. And he stretched out, surrendered like a little boy playing cops and robbers. I would guess the boy was 20. I was old enough to be his dad. I said, "You better be here just like that when I come back." At the foot of the staircase was blood and blonde hair. This was where Mrs. Garrett had landed when Mr. Prenuptial had come up behind her, foot first. Garrett had snapped and kicked his wife down the hard wooden stairs. This was where he had taken clippers or scissors and cut off his wife's hair. He had taken her vanity, de-beautified her, corrupted what many would see as a work of art. The way she now looked on the outside, how he had defiled her loveliness, that was the way he now felt about her in his heart. This was where he had assaulted the woman he'd promised to cherish before dragging her back up at least 30 wooden stairs. More blonde hair on those stairs and drops of blood showed that she hadn't been lying. She hadn't exaggerated what had been done. No man could take back the scars put on a woman's body, on her soul. He knew that. She would never be the same. No woman is beaten and raped and returns to being the same. She was lucky to be alive. That had angered him. Then he had thrown her in the pool just to amuse his anger, was willing to watch her drown. He'd kicked her down the stairs and blamed her for falling. He would have drowned her in the pool, then blamed her for drowning. I understood why she had never confronted him since they had married. It had never been safe to do so. The devil was in that man. And the devil believed himself righteous. His rage had rained down on her because he felt slighted, and this level of madness had been incoherent and unjust. He had come after me, after Jake Ellis, wanted to kill us to alleviate his pain. Garrett was dangerous. Not when he was alone in a room filled with alpha males. He hadn't been dangerous when he was at his kitchen table. Irritating, but never dangerous. But gun in hand, or when confronting softer women, when he had enlisted an army of warriors to do his dirty work, Garrett saw himself as being as powerful as a king. Upstairs, it sounded like a new battle had broken out. Again, it sounded like a raging bull charging into a solid wall. The noise was intense, terrifying. I raised my foot to hike the stairs, but I was in too much agony to climb. There was a small elevator just off the kitchen. Those came standard with overpriced mansions. I hobbled that way and pushed the button to take me to the second of 3 levels, the level that had 4 of the 9 bedrooms. When the elevator door closed, I leaned against the wall. Pain came at me in waves. The white caps made it hard to breathe. A shock of dizziness came hard and went fast. Felt like I was still underwater. I had to bend over for a second. In between 3 blinks, I thought about my daughter, Rachel Redmond. Jimmy Lee. They had said someone was tracking Jimmy Lee, so I had to go after Garrett. Death could have left here to go claim Jimmy Lee. And now Death was back for more entertainment, back to enjoy the minstrel show, if not for prey. With each ragged inhale and exhale, I felt it walking behind me, sipping on tea. Yeah, Death was back. And still, as I closed my eyes, no genie in the bottle. I needed to leave this shit show. I had my own problems. This had been the worst day of my life. But this wasn't done. I had no idea what the hell this fight was, why it was at this level, but it wasn't done. Dead or alive, I wasn't leaving without the African. If I had been killed and my body had been left in that pool and he was still alive, I knew he wouldn't leave without me. As soon as the elevator door opened, someone sprinted in like a linebacker, hit me hard before I could stand up, before I could raise the gun, charged and jammed me into the back of the carriage. He tackled me so hard, everything went black, and again I saw stars. He came at me with so much force, I thought the elevator was about to come apart and fall back to the ground floor. With a grunt, I felt the Glock loosen and drop from my hand. He started throwing blows. I had to bob and weave, had to move based on instinct, on years of being in the ring. Had to become a moving target, but he had me cornered, stayed on me, and made it hard to get my footing. Still, I had to find daylight, change this from defense to offense, and do the same, hit him with bricks and bombs. I fell into another fight for my life. Knew I had to kill another in order to stay alive. This is the way it had been in the Alligator State when things had gotten out of control working for San Bernardino. Baltasar Wachowiak had been the only man I had killed before tonight. I'd been lucky in Florida. Had made it out of that humid death trap, traumatized, but alive. It took 2 decades for shit to go wrong again. But this time, wet, damaged, beaten, unarmed, I wouldn't be the last man standing. Chapter 26. I took a punch, a solid shot that knocked me back to the wall, sent me backward like I had been shot out of a cannon. That blow buckled my knees, put me on my ass, and blurred the world. I looked up and saw a black boot raised high, about to stomp my face. I dodged the kick, caught his foot long enough to push him back, grunted, and did my best to throw him off balance and make that murderer stumble and fall. He was tired, bleeding, filled with anger, in a blind rage. While he was scrambling to get up, I snapped, "Jake Ellis! Charlie! Charlie! Come here, Gamal Nasser! Stop fighting me, motherfucker, before I hurt you! It's me, fool!" We had traded blows at lightning speed, had almost taken each other's heads off before I realized I was battling Jake Ellis. His face was bloodied, and some of that blood was in his eyes. He staggered back 2 steps, hands still in fists. "Kinswift? Bro, it's me. You called me by my real name. Commander Gamal Nasser. It's Ken Swift. Don't play with me. Black man, not you. It's me, your brother by another mother." I made it to my feet. Then I helped my wounded compadre get back to his. Jake Ellis was fucked up. He asked, "How'd you know I was here after that dumpster mail?" "I was here before you got here. You came after that cracker before I did? His boys jumped me, kidnapped me, and tried to drown me in the cement pond. They bricked my Mustang and set it on fire, and tried to set my building on fire. I was on the downstroke, and my lady was just arriving in heaven when my car alarm went off. You know I had to finish. We get a lot of false alarms. I went out, and Garrett and his gang came at me, then tried to shoot up Lamert Park." He coughed. "How many of Garrett's men left?" "Shit, you tell me. His bushwhackers came out of an ice cream truck like clowns in a circus car. I saw about 8 or 9. I left 3 with lead poisoning by the pool." Jake Ellis spat on the wooden floor. "I threw a couple out the window. That's 5. You ran 1 down the stairs. That's 6. Could be 2 left." There were at least 10 bullet holes in the walls. Jake Ellis had almost been shot in the head, but it just broke the flesh. An inch to the left, he'd be pushing up daisies. I asked, "Where's Garrett?" "In that bedroom. Master bedroom. He ran in there when he ran out of bullets." "What's he got in there?" "I don't know. Tried to ram and kick the bedroom door down. Door solid like a vault. I heard you when I was down by the pool." Jake Ellis looked around. Didn't spot a camera. "Tough like George Zimmerman. Take away the gun, he gets his sorry ass whooped by a kid every time. Stevie Wonder can see that." I rubbed a knot. "He clocked the back of my head when his bushwhackers held me. He had his men hold you while he hit you from behind, like a coward? Hit me with his gat. Pistol whipped me while his goons stomped me. Fuck that. Let's set this bitch on fire. Get some gas, pour it under that door, light a match, smoke him out. He'd either have to come out that door or jump out a window." "Neighborhood of old money. Firemen would get here as soon as we struck a match. A good fire would get on that ass and make him run out before the firemen and the cops. We don't want the cops here. He doesn't either. Cops come and he'll get lobster, but we won't make it to the gate." The elevator moved. It went back down to the first level. I said, "I left a fool down there. He wasn't hurt. Didn't want to shoot him." "He's coming with backup?" "He probably has his boys. And this time, I bet those boys have toys." "This shit is worse than Miami." Jake Ellis took the gun, aimed it at the elevator door. I checked the stairs to see if the bushwhackers had regrouped, multiplied like Norway rats, and were storming us from 2 directions. No one was on the shiny stairs. Elevator came back up. When the lift opened again, it was Mrs. Garrett, alone, on the floor, nude. Jake Ellis didn't recognize her. Mr. Garrett had done a Britney Spears on his wife's head, and she looked like she was a cancer patient on her last legs. The cold water had shriveled her skin. Her complexion was beyond pale. Then Jake Ellis did recognize her. He hurried to her. She raised a hand. Didn't want to be touched. I didn't have to say the damage she saw was done by Mr. Garrett. And Jake Ellis didn't have to ask. I said, he's a real tough guy. Some call Akufo-Addo the biggest coward in Ghana. Garrett is America's coward. She tried to get up. Couldn't. Needed assistance. Jake Ellis helped her to her feet, let her lean against the wall, and took off his bloodied hoodie, put it on her. It covered her like a miniskirt. She was ashamed and angry, wiped away tears, pulled the hood up, and covered her head. She asked,
"Where is my loving husband? Where is my dicky bird? Doesn't he know his apple booty needs him now, for better or for worse? We have company, and he's not entertaining or helping. I mean, there are dead men by the pool, a man outside crying over his broken legs."
Jake Ellis motioned toward the bedroom's double doors. 3-point locking system on each access. Even if we charged the entry at the same time, the doors wouldn't break open. She wiped away tears and yelled,
"Dicky Bird! Want to come out for some more gelato?"
There was no response. She turned to us.
"No worries. I have a key in my closet. I have a key because when he gets mad, he will lock me out. We can get in with my key. Bastard doesn't know I have a key."
Before I could ask, Jake pointed.
"The bedroom across from that one is her closet."
She walked toward a bedroom that had the same style doors, told us,
"Wait here."
While she dealt with shock and anger and wiped away more tears than were in her swimming pool, I asked what I really was concerned about. "Does he have more guns?" She shrugged.
"Don't know. I just know he has his toys everywhere. I know he bought guns like he was in the NRA's Gun of the Month Club. He was always going to Wyoming or someplace, always went to some gun show somewhere, then came back home with new toys. Once he brought back flowers and gave me chlamydia. Must have been a hell of a gun show."
Jake Ellis asked what was important.
"Did we get all the guns in the house?"
Tears dropped as Mrs. Garrett touched her bald head.
"You didn't get mine?"
I asked, "You have a piece?" San Bernardino didn't know that. We didn't know that.
"My husband doesn't know that. I hide it in the drawer that has my tampons and girly stuff. That's the drawer men will never look in. Had a 380 for 8 years, and he has no idea."
"What happened 8 years ago?"
"We had a black president. People were talking about race wars."
"Yeah. Well?"
"I was going to buy a .22, but the man at the gun shop told me the bullet might not penetrate the brain, said the bullets might follow the path of his skull. With a .380, no problem like that. That's why I hid out in my closet earlier. I love God with all my heart, and I prayed, but in case the internet in heaven was offline or my prayers went to God's spam folder like they always seem to do, I had my loaded pinky boo at my side, just in case he went a bit too berserk."
"A marriage built on secrets is a marriage built on a foundation of sand."
"This one was built on quicksand in a tornado. I'm not stupid. I can guess the things he does. He associates with ruthless people. I knew that one day it was going to get ugly around here. Bad people come and go, sit at our dinner table, swim in our pool. My closet would have been my hideout. And he gets mean. If he ever got crazy, didn't want him to know I had a gun, too."
"Why didn't you peel a cap at his ass tonight? Justice would be on your side."
"I don't know. I ain't never shot nobody before. Should have shot him 2 years ago when he gave me chlamydia. Now he's thrown me downstairs. He cut off all of my hair. He made me ugly. He beat my face and made me ugly. What kind of monster would do this to a woman?"
"The kind that would slap you with a prenup on your wedding day."
"A man with no heart. A control freak with no soul. A goddamn wannabe gangster."
But you jumped the broom. You married a man you didn't want to marry.
For the money. I guess. I mean, I could not marry him and crawl back to Coco's and beg for my job back. Made me feel like I was a fucking moron. I would have had to give him back the BMW. I couldn't go back to driving my ugly bucket and being a two-bit waitress for minimum wage. Not without people whispering. All the girls there were jealous. Real jealous. Those thoughts would have loved to have seen me fail. I would have been the laughingstock of Compton and Dominguez Hills. So yeah, yeah, to save face, I sucked it up and married Richard Israel Garrett III, Dicky Bird. They called him that in Boston. He had a bad leg when he was growing up, a Dicky leg, and he was puny until he went to Princeton. So they called him Dicky Bird until he made it to university. Then he was Garrett.
Macho, egotistical guy like him seems like he'd want people to call him Butch.
No, but he's mean and calls his sister Butch. She's the South End's biggest lesbian. She's a cop. I think she is the reason he left Boston. She hates him. He doesn't talk to her. Told her when she got off the clit and back on the dick, then maybe they could be family again.
His nickname needs some Viagra. And you married Dicky Bird for the money.
At first it was for love. Would have been happy being the dutiful wife. Would have lived to please my husband. But on my wedding day it changed. And I guess it became for money. I was angry. I was going to marry him and try and take everything. Just never figured out how to do it.
I said, the key? Mind getting the key?
She moved like the walking dead. Went to her closet. A closet the size of my apartment. A closet that had a bed and a full bathroom. When she came back, she had pulled on funky leggings and put on red chucks, but still had on Jake Ellis's hoodie, her head and face covered.
Let's open the door and see how Dicky Bird's doing. Let me see if he's happy to see me after I didn't die. He beat me like I was a dog. He raped me. He locked me in a closet and let me suffer and bleed half to death. He paraded me around naked in front of all those strange men, and he threw me in the pool and tried to drown me. Like I wasn't shit.
I said, we're both having bad days.
So, since I've lasted through the in sickness and in health part of the contract, this little naive girl from Compton is ready to see how this until death do we part is going to work out.
I stepped up. Okay, but we can't just break up in there not knowing if he's armed.
Then she snapped, and yes, all of his art was stolen. Stolen from all over the world.
Jake Ellis said, some is from Africa, and it is authentic.
He hates Africa, but he knows that's where the easy money is, the money that can't be traced when moved offshore. Him and all his rich friends are going to African countries trying to make bank. They want to chop up Libya, or did he say Liberia? I know it started with an L.
They come, take, never give. Rubber from our trees, diamonds from our mines, gold from our land. African leaders are complicit. They will sell our country to the highest bidder. They call it good business. I call it bullshit. Colonialism by another name is still colonialism. Nigeria could unite Africa, and Africa could rule the world if they allowed merit rule instead of mediocrity.
She sobbed.
He has had mistresses, several. One was the housekeeper. I fired her.
Water dripping, making a puddle at my feet. I said, really?
That's what we were arguing about when we came home from shopping today.
Jake Ellis said, well, at least you came home to the magically moist salmon.
He had hidden a bottle of Viagra and condoms in the glove box. A box of three. Two missing. We haven't used condoms. Ever. And the extra Viagra was 100 milligrams, bottle of 20, week-old prescription, over half already used up. So he had a secret prescription. He knew I counted the pills in his cabinet, and we haven't used one in a very, very long time.
Congratulations, you're definitely married.
We've got 9 months. Wait, once we went a year. Best year of our marriage.
Why get married and not have sex?
He knows I want a baby.
Wanted.
Even if I freeze eggs, they are no good without the secret sauce, and he has the damn sauce. He has to control everything. I wanted a baby so I would have someone to love and love me back. That's sad, huh? Makes me feel pathetic to admit that. I'm glad we don't have one. Who would want their child to ever see their mother looking like this? If he did this to me, just think of what he'd do to his child.
He wouldn't touch the child. Men don't usually go Andrea Yates on the kids.
I bet I wouldn't be the first woman he's done away with.
They don't kill children, but rich men always do away with the mother.
Right, like O.J. or Robert Blake. A lot of that kill-the-mother shit going around California.
Sounds like he did everything but Phil Spector you and call it suicide.
Dickie Bird pushed me downstairs, bashed my head, tried to break my neck, and then he tried to drown me like a roach. He did things that assholes do when they want to prove they own a woman. He's stronger. But I fought him back. People in my family hurt fast and bleed quick, but we don't die easily. He's got me mixed up with those weak girls from Altadena or Monrovia.
No woman expects this to happen in her life.
I'm not stupid. I knew what to expect when you marry a man like him. Knew shit wasn't going to be a fairy tale when he had his lawyer hem me up with that damn prenup. I know rich men have their ways. He told me his ancestors used to rob banks, stagecoaches, and trains. Didn't bother me. Mine shot craps in the back rooms of bars and drank liquor out of brown bags in pissy alleys. I can take a lot of shit. I mean, I put up with a lot of shit. Can put up with him being cheap, can turn a blind eye to lots of things he has done. To the women. But I can't take this.
He went full Boston on you. He tried to kill you.
Why do all that? Why torture me? Why didn't he just shoot me in my head?
Wanted you to suffer before you died. Wanted to humiliate you, like you did him. She groaned.
I think my arm is broken. It hurts. My legs hurt from falling, too. He bumped my head over and over. Everything is kind of blurry, off and on, but I can hang on a little longer.
Jake Ellis said,
"We will take care of this, then get you to a hospital to see the Sinai."
If I go to the hospital, they'll call the police and I'll have to tell them what happened.
He scares you.
Men like him is why Clara Harris will always be my hero.
Neither Jake Ellis nor I had any idea who Clara Harris was. We didn't care. Mrs. Garrett stepped to the side, arms folded across her chest, angry, shivering. Jake Ellis motioned.
Go lock yourself in your closet. Stay safe in your panic room.
Her jaw tightened.
I'm done being a coward. I want him to see he didn't destroy me. Still, we need you to step back. Let this be between bad men.
She looked at us.
Don't kill him. If you kill him, things will get worse.
Jake Ellis said,
I'll try not to.
Apple Booty did take a step back, moved closer to the double doors leading to her closet. Jake Ellis and I took deep breaths, evaluated wounds, readied ourselves to attack. Thoughts came in dark flashes. Dead bodies were cooling by the pool. Injured and dying men decorated the patio in the first level of the house. Like I had offered those other black men, we could call it a push, lick our wounds, and hobble away. But like those institutionalized men, we weren't trained to back down. We didn't walk away. We hadn't walked away in 2 decades. We were institutionalized in our own way. Too many black lives lived behind invisible walls. America still had thousands of sundown towns, and this elite city might have been one. Garrett could be bold and call the slave catchers. He could break the code, then deal with San Bernardino later. He was in fight or flight, and he wasn't fighting. And no one was left to combat on his behalf. If I heard sirens, there would be dozens of cop cars, cars that had barking dogs, and cops who never used rubber bullets or tasers. If black men weren't wearing football gear, even when wearing the same hoodies and hipster gear white men wore with Birkenstocks, to the biased eye, we all looked like prison inmates. Guilty until proven innocent, and no one on this property was innocent. Even Mrs. Garrett was complicit. Mr. Garrett would point at us, and the protect and serve crew, men and women who respected his hue, would see my swarthy skin, would see Jake Ellis's dark skin, and right away think we were in league with other men scattered all over the property. Garrett could claim we all broke in to steal his precious art and rape his wife. He could say we attacked his wife, and maybe she'd think twice, clam up, let us take that charge. She had too much to lose. I'd saved her life, but I didn't trust her. I knew my history, knew her history, knew my bias, had to acknowledge my preconceived notions,
but my gut instincts wouldn't let me trust her. But we were pissed off. We had the same adversary. We were all cold, sweating, furious, tired, bleeding, half past dead. Mrs. Garrett looked like Rihanna after an evening with Chris Brown. Garrett had come after me and Jake Ellis. We had been disrespected on our own turf. Jake Ellis had been dodging bullets, and I'd been gaffled, beat down, and could barely walk straight. We didn't start shit, but we ended it. Jake Ellis never backed down. I wasn't no punk either. Never would be. Jake Ellis handed me the Glock. He glanced at me and probably figured I needed it. I looked back at Mrs. Garrett, was going to leave the gun with her, but the battered housewife shook her head, wouldn't touch it. I assumed she wanted to keep her fingerprints off the Nina. Again, that was the wrong answer to me. If she could get us all dead, she would win the grand prize. I'd seen that blockbuster movie before, where all the men were killed, and the femme fatale ended up on a Caribbean beach, sipping margaritas, rich, widowed, a dreadlocked lover for hire at her side. I stood next to a man who didn't know how to lose. On the other side of the door was a man built from the same steel. An unstoppable force had met an immovable object. I didn't want to be here. Was as battered as Mrs. Garrett. I was ready to leave, not out of fear. I was suffering. But I didn't know if Garrett's bushwhackers had hurt Jimmy Lee. She could be dead. She could be in a car that had been bricked and set on fire. She had been my first love, the mother of my disrespectful child. I couldn't leave, couldn't pretend this shit didn't happen, sip brown liquor, use Kush to ease the pain, put Band-Aids on my wounds, and crawl back in bed with Rachel Redmond. Couldn't go on with my life without knowing whether Jimmy Lee had been dragged into this. Even when it felt like I would drown, Jimmy Lee's safety was on my mind. She never left my mind, not a day, for 20 goddamn years. Jake Ellis said, "Roth, you're shaking. You okay?" I nodded. "I'm always ready, especially when I'm not." Ego was the anesthesia that deadened the pain of stupidity, and death killed egos. No anesthesia needed. Nothing killed stupidity. Stupidity had survived for millions of years. Like kudzu, it spread and spread and spread. It was a cockroach in the mind. Jake Ellis took the key, twisted it in the keyhole, turned the door handle. Six locks clicked and disengaged. As soon as the door opened, bullets flew our way. Garrett screamed and fired. I fired back. 8 bullets left. 7, 6, 5, then 4. Garrett's shots matched mine as his insults matched Jake Ellis's. And each time, Mrs. Garrett screeched and made her apple booty jiggle. Jake Ellis wanted to rush into the room, his rage the lie that made him feel bulletproof. We were invading a master bedroom like it was a Middle Eastern country filled with oil, busy taking shots and being shot at until the clip ran dry. We pushed the doors open, and Garrett was alone. No bushwhackers, but he held his gun. A nice gun that had no bullets. He tried to fire again. The bitch was bone dry. He casually put the gun in his waistband. It wasn't a sign of surrender. He had other weapons. He reached for 2 knives, held one in each hand. Swords, actually. He had swords with short blades, the kind made for gutting a man. Garrett was out of breath, stress sweating, looking at us like he was a zombie killer. He wasn't gonna go down easily, and he was still determined to take out Jake Ellis. Garrett grinned that monkey grin. "I ain't scared of you motherfuckers. Come taste this metal."
Chapter 27. Jake Ellis didn't back away, so I pressed forward. Moving in opposite directions, we picked up lamps to use as weapons, something to block those blades, and we had one in each hand. Garrett huffed, puffed, then yelled, came at us swinging his blades, swinging his blades, swinging his blades. Garrett charged at us, and we each threw a lamp. Jake Ellis's missed, but mine hit Garrett's right arm. That didn't stop the fat man who was once a boxer at Princeton from getting his balance and trying to cut our heads off. We were in an oversized bedroom that had a sitting area, king-size Italian bed, art, and pictures of him and his wife when they were married. The room was the size of the actual park in Leimert Park.
We tore up shit as we moved around his playground, pulled the big screen off the wall, threw anything that wasn't nailed down, but he wouldn't let go of his blades. An explosion came from behind us. A bullet hit a floor-to-ceiling mirror on the wall. Glass rained to the floor. Jake Ellis and I both jumped, looked back, and expected to see a well-armed league of bushwhackers here to protect their benefactor. I was ready to duck and dodge bullets.
It was Mrs. Garrett.
She could barely stand, but had her .380 in her right hand. It was a pretty gun, blushing pink with a handle made of pink swirling pearls, a sweet customized Ruger LCP made to look like a work of art. I wondered if it was loaded with pretty pink bullets, too. She used the doorframe to hold herself up.
Dickie Bird, put down the imported knives. Those are not toys. Those are stolen from Asia, and you know those are very, very expensive.
I bought these.
I saw the invoice from a man who stole them. Still stolen, like everything else.
Where'd you get a gun from, Elaine?
Gun fairy.
Doesn't look real. The bald and wounded woman fired another shot, that one closer to her husband. She repeated,
"Sweetie, put the knives down. Next time, I won't miss. You're gonna shoot me? No, but you're not gonna cut up the man who saved me from drowning. I can't let you do that. So put the knives down, or I will shoot you in your nuts just to hear you scream."
He commanded, "Throw me that gun."
"No,"
he snapped. "Give me the fucking gun."
"You raped me."
"Elaine,
you raped me like I was some drunk bitch behind a dumpster."
"A husband can't rape his wife."
"Your mantra. It's in the Bible. I hated you before, but I really, really hate you now.
I love you. You just make me a little crazy. You drive me crazy, Apple Booty."
Her voice weakened, her soft spot.
"Don't call me that. I love you."
She fired another shot into the bedroom's 105-inch curved 4K TV, and that was like throwing $100,000 in C-notes on a bed of fire. But like Garrett had said, when you didn't make the money, its accoutrements had no value. Right now, Mrs. Garrett had lost her sweetness and was capable of burning this bitch down. I stepped to the side of her ire, and so did Jake Ellis. Even a small woman, a demure woman, when enraged, terrified men like us. The dam burst, and she limped to and fro, waggling her gun, ranting.
"This house is nothing but a zoo, and you have been the zookeeper. I was your favorite pet animal. You kept me pretty, you fed me, just like I was an animal living in a cage. You bought me things like they were treats, gave me nice shoes like you were giving an animal an extra bone under the table. This is a zoo, a roadside zoo, and not even a good zoo. Beautiful creatures caged in a roadside zoo made of marble and glass and bricks, where your possessions don't have basic rights to freedom and everything else that makes their lives meaningful. This is a zoo where you beat animals when they don't do what you want them to do or when they misbehave."
What can I do to fix this, Elaine? Talk to me. Fuck, Elaine, lower the damn gun.
I'm shaking. Can't stop shaking now. I've been filled with anxiety for too long.
Elaine, I overreacted. I'm sorry. I overreacted.
She coughed like gallons of pool water was still in her lungs, coughed like she was rattling with pneumonia, then wiped her swollen lips, wiped her mouth, and spoke in a choppy, raspy, getting sick voice.
"You have disappointed me, Dickie Bird, since our wedding day,"
Garrett said.
"I'll change the prenup. I will call and make it effective immediately."
She fired again, shot and almost hit him.
"Zookeeper, you brutalized me, treated me like chattel, worse than a mutt, like one of your commodities, and kicked me down the stairs. You're the animal. You're the dog. You're the rabbit two-legged dog, and you need to be put down."
"I'll change the goddamn prenup, Elaine."
"I can change it myself."
She took a breath, felt her physical pain, touched her bald head, coughed a few more times, then looked at Garrett, tears in her beet-red eyes.
"Dickie Bird, I can change it myself. With one bullet, Zookeeper, I can change everything with one bullet."
Knives in hands, nowhere to go,
The businessman tried to barter. Elaine, bloodied lips, trembled. Tears rained from blood-red eyes.
You tried to drown me.
Frustrated, Garrett clanged his blades together.
Elaine!
Knives. Down.